Testing. This is Thornton Page speaking at the Johnson Space Center. Testing. 1, 2, 3, 4. These informal comments record my memories of Gerard Kuiper, whom I had known since 1938 when I first joined the staff of the University of Chicago and the Yerkes Observatory. At that time, Gerard was working on Beta Lyrae, a close double star for which he had many spectral observations and had built an elaborate model showing the dynamics of a close pair of stars, research which I know influenced many other studies of double stars and stellar evolution. Those early days at Yerkes were a fascinating experience under the leadership of Otto Struve with some of the other people, now well-known astronomers, Jesse Greenstein, Henye, Morgan, and the older member of the staff, George van Beesbroek. Kuiper has always been an extremely active astronomer, and he was at that time. One amusing story had to do with his effort to recover a large meteorite, which was seen sometime in early 1940. Several reports from nearby farmers indicated that this meteorite, a very bright bolide, was moving southward and appeared to have landed just beyond the southern horizon. So Gerard and I tried to locate it so that we could obtain a fresh meteorite. However, somewhat to our chagrin, our investigation showed that it kept on going and was seen over Louisiana, many hundreds of miles farther south. And our efforts to obtain a meteorite were therefore foiled. Although I didn't work with Gerard Kuiper on any joint research at that time, I was often with him at the McDonald Observatory, both of us using the new 82-inch telescope, and on one occasion I caused him some trouble. It was when he was photographing various planets and a systematic search for new satellites. And he discovered first in 1948 Miranda, the fifth satellite of Uranus, and in 1949 Nereid, extra satellite of Neptune. I was using a fast spectrograph at the prime focus of the 82-inch telescope, and had a wire which was necessary for electrical power from the edge of the telescope out to the instrument at the center. And his discovery photograph of Nereid unfortunately was somewhat affected by the presence of that wire. It caused the diffraction pattern of the bright planet to be asymmetrical. Kuiper was very active in extending his investigations of the planets, and in 1950 measured the diameter of Pluto with the 200-inch telescope at Mount Palomar. He did this with a number of small apertures drilled in a sheet of metal in the Yerkes shop, and matched the size of Pluto's image in the 200-inch with the accurately drilled holes, finding that the angular diameter at that time was 2/300 of a second of arc. I believe still the best measurement of Pluto's diameter. I think Gerard was the first to propose that the source, or the origin of Pluto, was as an escaped satellite of Neptune, this being based on the orbits of the two planets. Those early days at McDonald were also extremely exciting ones, with Struve, who took the lead in establishing the observatory after a number of investigations of sites, primarily by Van Beesbroek. As I guess everyone knows, Kuiper and Van Bee were very close friends, and in his later years, Van Beesbroek continued to work with Girard at the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory at the University of Arizona. In any case, the early McDonald days were interesting partly because of the hardships on the mountain. Rather few places to live. There were two fairly solid houses built for the local resident director, C.T. Elby, and for Dr. Struve, and then some rather cheesy buildings of wood that tended to leak when there was a strong wind. I remember one of them, the rugs would coast around when the wind was blowing hard because of updraft through the floor. At that time, we had no electric power on the mountain except that generated for the operation of the telescope with a diesel generator. And so the cooking and lighting of these small residences was all by gas. I should mention that another early resident there was Carl Seyfert, whose studies of extragalactic objects have earned him considerable fame. Kuiper was extremely interested in McDonald, both because of his early activities in establishing it and because of the excellent observing opportunities there, and became director of the McDonald Observatory, I believe, in 1950. At that time, I had certain administrative duties at the University of Chicago and helped both obtain a new local director, Marlon Krebs, and to establish the installation of commercial electric power that I think improved conditions on Mount Locke. The person who deserves great credit for the continued running of McDonald Observatory at that time was Dorothy Hines, the secretary, who also lived on the top of the mountain, and I believe is now a schoolteacher up in Williams Bay, Wisconsin. Girard Kuiper took a great deal of interest in improving various things on the top of Mount Locke, and I remember in particular the pathways between the observatory and the various houses, which he laid out and supervised the construction of, sometimes with criticism from other astronomers who used the observatory. At the end of World War II, Kuiper was engaged in interesting military operation to try to recover the German scientists who might otherwise have been lost in the unsettled conditions at the end of the war. He was a member of Project Paperclip. I don't recall too much about it at this point, except that Sam Goudschmidt was another member. They were all scientists of renown who understood German and other continental languages, and whose job it was to find various scientists and get them back here to the United States for their safekeeping. One of these was Carl Friedrich von Weizsäcker, a German theoretical physicist of some note, and Kuiper arranged to get him to Yerkes in 1949. Shortly before that time, and continuing at Yerkes, von Weizsäcker worked on the theory of the origin of the solar system, an attempt primarily to account for the Bode-Titius law of spacing of the planets in their orbits around the sun. This led Kuiper to think a good deal more about the origin of the solar system, a topic which I'd attempted to summarize in several articles. And he produced the concepts for what I believe is now the accepted theory based on condensation of planets from a primordial solar nebula. The original concept probably came from his association with von Weizsäcker concerning the effect of vortices forming in a rotating nebula. Kuiper's theory of the origin was discussed at many meetings that I attended, and in private discussion, and described qualitatively by Kuiper on a number of occasions, but I believe it was only in the last year or so that he got to summarize it completely and quantitatively in a paper which I've seen parts of and hope to see published in the very near future. Returning to those post-war years, around 1948-49, Kuiper began observing infrared emissions from planets, and I think was the first to exploit this portion of the spectrum. I remember some excellent infrared photographs he took from the roof of the Yerkes Observatory showing Lake Geneva as a perfectly black body because of the infrared absorption of water. Using infrared film in those days was by no means simple, and Girard developed the technique. He also obtained the so-called Cashman cell, which was an infrared-sensitive detector that had been developed during the war years, and used it to observe, among other things, the color, infrared color, of Mars. He got the idea that he could identify the rocks on the surface of Mars from these infrared spectra. At that time, I'd just married my present wife, Lou Williams Page, who is a PhD in geology from Chicago, and we obtained from the the mineral collection at the university a number of rocks that might be of similar nature to those on Mars. However, Girard had picked up a piece of rhyolite somewhere near Mount Locke in Texas and considered that its infrared spectrum closely matched that of Mars. Using his equipment, my wife and I showed that several other rocks, several other minerals, would match it equally well, so that this technique of identifying rocks on Mars was not entirely without ambiguity. Kuiper had shown that there is no chlorophyll band in the light reflected from the Martian surface, and that would indicate that none of the green coloring on the surface of the planet could be due to plant life, at least as we know it. And he proposed a theory at that time that if there was life on Mars, it might be in the form of lichens or other dual-type organisms that would not show the chlorophyll bands. In 1960, Gerard Kuiper left the Yerkes Observatory and founded the Lunar and Planetary Lab at the University of Arizona. This gave him time to allowed him to devote all his time to the study of planets, satellites, and other bodies in the solar system, and in particular to study the surface of the moon. The major purpose, I guess, was for the seeking landing points for spacecraft that would be landing on the moon during the decade of the 60s, part of them in preparation for the Apollo program of putting the first man on the moon. Kuiper mapped the near side of the moon with great accuracy, and was, I guess, the principal investigator in the Ranger close-up photographs taken in the early 60s. I remember when he arrived at the IAU meetings in Prague in 1967, he was very proud of the Ranger photographs that had been taken, and in special sessions of the IAU showed them to astronomers there from all over the world. I had also left the Yerkes Observatory and was working in Washington for the military at that time, but kept close contact with Gerard and knew of his many efforts to interpret the features, the surface features of the moon. I remember one occasion when he was very eager to get my help in obtaining airplane views of snow-covered terrain on the Earth to compare with various portions of the lunar landscape under different lighting conditions. His concern at that time was the mounds or volcanic mounds on the moon, distinct from the impact craters. His idea of the snow-covered terrain was that the snow covering would somewhat match the regolith on the moon, which had been piled on top of the possible volcanic mounds, covering them in the same way snow would cover the Earth's surface. Because I had been working on atomic weapons in Washington, the question came up of making a crater on the moon, and Gerard and I wrote one proposal to use an impacting spacecraft to carry an atomic warhead to strike the surface and dig a deep hole. The argument was that from the flash we might obtain spectral information on the nature of the material there, and from examining the crater, man-made crater later on, we might learn something of the subsurface structure. This plan never went through, probably because of the undesirable aspect of contaminating the moon with radioactive materials. After this long history of planetary research and the establishment of the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory, it seemed a good idea to propose Gerard P. Kuiper as Director of Science at the Manned Spacecraft Center here in Houston. When a vacancy occurred in 1968, I did that, and he was brought here several occasions and interviewed, and I believe offered the job, although he decided, as he told me later, that he would prefer to stick with the Lunar and Planetary Lab, and in effect turned down the position here at the Manned Spacecraft Center. As things turned out, I think Gerard would have been an excellent director during the several years of collecting science on the lunar surface, collecting scientific data, and would greatly have enjoyed the tremendous amount of information that flowed in from Apollo's 14, 15, 16, and 17. I've tried to give some of the highlights in my memories of Gerard Kuiper. I can't refrain from mentioning two amusing feuds that went on, one between him and Bart Bock, both of them Dutchmen, and possibly somewhat jealous of the success, each one of the other. And another feud with Harold Urey, mainly concerned with theories of the origin of the solar system. In both of these, I think Gerard exhibited a great sense of humor, and I'm sure that before his untimely death, these differences of opinion or jealousies were largely forgotten. Other aspects of his life that I've had some contact with include his editing the University of Chicago series of books on astronomy, where his major help came from Barbara Middlehurst, and his establishment of the Catalina Observatory, I believe it's southeast of Tucson. Two of my friends were heavily involved in the latter, Harold Johnson, who's, I guess, served at the Lunar and Planetary Lab since the beginning, observing photoelectric colors, and Henry Hill, a physicist, first at the Wesleyan University in Connecticut, who wished to measure with new equipment the ellipticity of the solar image and the Einstein shift of stars close to the sun. Kuiper, I know, was very helpful to both these men, and they've completed work of considerable importance on Catalina Mountain. The last few contacts I've had with Gerard concerned his studies of the atmosphere of Venus and evidence of rather complex molecules that apparently are formed in the upper part of that atmosphere. We also corresponded and telephoned one another about the possibility of other craters being formed on the moon by impacts of the various spacecraft that were not needed in orbit around the moon, and about my far ultraviolet camera, which was carried on Apollo 16 and apparently detected hydrogen, very low-density hydrogen, in a sort of lunar atmosphere. As I've said, Gerard Kuiper was an extremely active and effective astronomer, and no one person could try to summarize the many contributions he made to the subject. Among the students at the Yerkes Observatory, the University of Arizona, and younger members of the staff at the LPL, he's produced many other effective astronomers, and his books, I'm sure, have been used to train many more. I considered him a great friend, and am proud to have known him. This is the end of my comments on Gerard Kuiper. This is Thornton Page, the Johnson Space Center.